Welcome to the Global Investor Podcast, a show that focuses on helping foreign investors enter the lucrative U.S. real estate market. Host Charles Carrillo combines decades of real estate investing experience with a professional background in international banking to interview experts in all areas of U.S. real estate investing. Now, here's your host, Charles Carrillo.
Welcome to another episode of the Global Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Charles Carrillo. Today we have Mustafa Ladia. He is a multifamily investor and his firm specializes in leveraging secondary and tertiary real estate markets to seek an attractive risk and return profile for an array of investors that he has. And they offer a multifamily debt fund, a multifamily equity fund, and also they handle single property syndications. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much, Charles. I really appreciate it.
So can you give us a little background of yourself, both personally and professionally, prior to getting involved with real estate investing?
Yeah, sure. Originally, I studied genetics with a minor in religion. I went to med school. I decided it wasn't for me. And then like a lot of people, I was trying to figure out, you know, what the next step is. And that ultimately led me to real estate. I was really searching for, you know, passive income stream, different, you know, options and strategies to ideally retire before 65, to be in a position where, you know, I don't have to like rely on my 401k or Social Security or anything like that. So for me, it really fundamentally came down to, you know, there's so many different ways to make money, but fundamentally making money boils down to adding value for people. And that's really how I started my journey. I looked at how do I add value and what's the most strategic way to add value and what's the most scalable way to add value. And for me, a lot of that came down to who do I know in my network? What are they doing? What are they successful at? And how can I add value for them to really shorten my learning curve and really position myself where I'm adding value to somebody? And then ultimately, they're adding value to me as well. Kind of what we would say today is like finding a mentor, very simply, right?
Right.
And the people in my space happen to be in real estate. They happen to be doing deals. They happen to be raising capital. So that's really what I focused on. I said, okay, let me understand the business. Let me understand the deal flow. Let me understand how they're making money and how other people can make money and how I can make it a win-win for everyone. And that's really what I've gone about doing, you know, more or less my whole professional life.
When you started out in real estate, because you went over a couple of the reasons why you did that, but can you go over kind of what your first real estate investment was, how you got really involved on your first deal?
Sure, sure. So very simply, I, you know, came in, I was excited. It was around 2018. You had a lot of crowdfunding platforms that were, you know, starting and then failing. And every year the crowdfunding space was different, especially in real estate in terms of, you know, the titans of the industry. So for me, I felt like there was a huge opportunity to really leverage technology and really leverage, you know, the regulations and Reg A and things of that nature to raise capital online. At the same time, I recognized it costs a lot of money to do that. So I came out, you know, with a strategy, you know, to my mentor to say, hey, listen, you know, you give me X, I'll be able to raise Y, and this is what it'll look like. And very simply, the conversation is, why would I do that when I can just invest this money in real estate and have a more streamlined way to make money? So I'm like, okay, that makes sense. Let me circle back. Let me build an MVP, a minimum viable product, and let me prove out this, you know, this theory. So that's more or less what I did. I took those deals that he was going to fund himself. He was deploying, you know, 820K across three properties. I said, okay, I'm going to raise some money for this. You know, what are you projecting that you can pay investors? So he said anywhere from 3 to 4.5% in 3 months. So a short timeline, you know, decent ROI. And it was really a value add strategy. So I raised, you know, 205K for that project. Investors made 4.5% in 3 months. And then I scaled from there. And, you know, the cost of acquiring that capital was zero, right? It was, I mean, my time, obviously, but zero in terms of like a marketing spend and things of that nature. So then I, you know, within 3 months, I raised $1 million from that same group of investors. Obviously, the first time around, they made their 200K back and profit. They, you know, invested $1 million. And then over the next, you know, 5 years, I really scaled that out, you know, again, with, you know, zero ad spend, things of that nature, and really creating a structure where people can invest passively, creating a structure that, you know, makes sense to investors and enabling them to feel comfortable from investing $1 million to now over $20 million, primarily on WhatsApp.
Nice. Yeah, and I want to get into that in a little bit. One of the things I want to get into, dig into more, is about your individual investment philosophy, because it's when I was looking over your different markets, and everybody has a different way of how they run business, how they raise funds, and how they've you know, really curated their business. Can you go into a little bit more about the strategies and of how you work with your investors and why you do this?
Yeah, sure. I think it's a great question. So at a very basic level, when I introduce the firm or when I talk about what we do, I say, hey, we finance ground up construction. And then, you know, sometimes people will ask follow up questions based on, you know, their how comfortable they are with real estate. So it can be anywhere from, you know, 6-unit development to, you know, 288-unit development. So for a lot of people, that's a huge space and it doesn't necessarily make sense. And it's a byproduct of the market we invest in. We're not in the Sun Belt where there's a lot of land and there's like a lot of people doing big complexes. We're in the Northeast where land is, you know, more like quote unquote more valuable, harder to come by, et cetera. And we invest in opportunity zones, right? So the areas we invest in, they're pro rezoning. There's huge tax benefits to rezoning. So if we can at scale do multiple 6-unit projects, we're going to do them. If those 6 units are next to each other, we're going to rezone and do a 40 unit. It just depends on where those lots are located, where those single family houses are located that we're rezoning. And then that kind of scales up and says, hey, we can do bigger projects or we can do a lot of small projects that scale all around the city. And that's really what we've been doing as a firm for over a decade now.
Yeah, I love that strategy because it's I'm originally from Connecticut, so from the Northeast as well. And so we know exactly the tri-state, so know exactly that there's a lack of property and nothing like the complexes we have down here where I am down in Florida now and the Southeast in general, South Atlantic. So going further into that, you mentioned the Opportunity Zone, which is a very interesting investment strategy. We haven't spoken about it in a while. And can you go over this? As I understand, there's like 8,000 plus of these zones in the United States. And can you go over what the benefits are for you and investors to invest and really revitalize these areas?
Yeah. So there's so many different ways to tackle the question. Like when I think of the average investor, I just think about how much money they probably want to make because you're investing with the intention of making profit. So from that angle, when you're investing in an opportunity zone, and there's a difference between a qualified opportunity zone fund and investing in an opportunity zone. All right, so opportunity zone is at the most basic level, the actual property. So when you're investing in an opportunity zone, that means that the land that you're investing in is in an area that needs to be revitalized at the federal and local level. What that means in English, in fifth grade level English, is you're investing in a not nice area and you're trying to make it nice. And in that, there's risk and in that, there's opportunity. The government has decided that there is too much risk. So there's not enough opportunity, not enough developers coming in and investing capital. So they're going to de-risk the investment for you by way of reducing your tax liability, right? Because they can't just throw you money, right? So they need to figure out a situation to make it make sense for you to readjust your risk profile. So now for some investors, they'll say, oh, hey, you're gentrifying the area and that's bad. And I say, yeah, that's a valid perspective. I'm also hiring locally and putting money into the economy and creating jobs. So that's why like I typically focus on the numbers, but you know, just a couple of days ago, I had a question on a different podcast or a different, you know, show, the more interactive, where I was talking about gentrification. And so I wanted to just touch on that as well. Like, you know, fundamentally all opportunity zones are in bad areas. If no one ever invests in a bad area, it never becomes a good area. And so you have to have a certain type of investor who takes that initiative to say, hey, I'm going to be that lead investor. I foresee in 10 years, this market that's 30 to 45 minutes from New York City will be a gold mine and it'll be printing money. How do I bridge that today? The risk profile doesn't make sense. Then an opportunity zone comes along and says, hey, normally if you had a multifamily apartment complex, you'd be paying, let's say, $60,000 in taxes a year. Instead, you're going to pay $3,000 in taxes a year. So what happens to that $57,000? It goes to your net operating income. That's money in your pocket each year, which means your asset is now worth more because it appraises at a higher value because the cap rates stay the same. The net operating income increased. So now your asset is worth more, which means you can either cash flow more or leverage the asset more. So ultimately, it's a defensive feature for investors. And depending on the opportunity zone and depending on the laws, it's either a 20-year tax abatement or a 30-year tax abatement. Typically, it's 10 years where the taxes are only on the value of the land. And then, you know, years 11 through 20, it's 5% of improvements. So now what happens over that 20-year period is rent also goes up, presumably, let's say at a 3%, you know, rise based on the national average. So you have rent going up, you have your taxes staying the same for the first 10 years. And then ultimately year 11 to 20 taxes are going up. But because you've benefited so much from the first 10 years and rent has gone up so much, et cetera, you're in a good position. And that's just like looking at the numbers. We didn't talk about the market appreciating, where it was maybe a C-class market and now it's like a B-class market. And over there, there's also massive appreciation for your asset and cap rates and asset values. So at a medium level, Charles, that's kind of how it breaks down.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for that explanation. Yeah, what I found is when I speak to operators that have successfully done this is that it's finding the opportunity zones that are really on that line between right on a neighborhood that, let's just say, is more ideal for an investor. And that's really the game of getting into. And I understand the gentrification argument on both sides. But also, yes, you're going to go into these areas that will never get capital. And there is going to be capital going into them. And that doesn't mean the whole area is going to be, you know, going to be renovated and changed in A-class apartment complexes everywhere. It's just you're little by little kind of pushing that line back out to make it, you know, you're making a city nicer than it was before. And but of course, whatever you do, somebody's going to be mad with it, right?
No, I think I 100% agree with you, Charles. And it's interesting because these conversations, like, context is so important. In the market, we're in the average inventory is 1955. That's after we've done 1,000 units ground up. So 1,000 units between, let's say, 2018 and 2024, and still the average is 1955. So we have like 70% of inventory that is pre-1940s. When we entered the market over a decade ago, it was a D-class neighborhood. Now it's like a C plus class neighborhood. So for us, you know, we experience a lot of demand because we market our units at the same cost as those 1940s inventory. So people aren't paying more, but they're getting a better product. What that means for us is the timeline for stabilization is so much quicker. So we have situations where we can stabilize, or we have stabilized, you know, 24 unit complexes in 3 months, with 23 of the first 24 units being stabilized in the first month, because we keep demand so high intentionally, because we, you know, we look at it from both perspectives. Fundamentally, if we're doing good and creating value for the community, we're able to monetize off that value as well. There's no need to necessarily aggressively raise rent or anything like that. So that's the thing with sometimes with that gentrification conversation, it's like, let's take a step back and let's look at the actual numbers. Let's look at what's actually happening. And then we can talk about whether it's good or bad for the individual.
Right. And what I've seen in these areas when opportunity zones and there's been development there to in these areas, it's just that you've seen a decrease in crime. So even if you're not living in the property, if you're near to the property, no one's going to complain about a decrease in crime. So it's something that, or they shouldn't, I mean, probably will, but it's something that, it's going to be it's a huge benefit. If you're in the property, you're near the property, or you're in the city at whole, I mean, it just makes it, I think it's a win-win for everybody that's involved in that area.
100% agree.
So you spoke about before about how you guys raise money for deals, and you mentioned a couple phrases, regulation, Reg A, and then also Reg D. And can you go into a little bit more, a little bit of an overview of exactly what a Reg A offering is and what a Reg D offering is and why you would utilize one or the other?
Sure. So at a very basic level, everyone's familiarity with real estate, private placement investments is different. So a lot of times when I'm talking to somebody, you know, new or through a referral, et cetera, the conversation kind of comes down to like, how do you want to make money? Do you want a short-term structure that's kind of like a cross between a high-yield savings account and a dividend stock where you can make money monthly? If so, that's our Reg D debt fund, right? I'm not going to talk about performance because legally I don't want it to be that I'm advertising anything. So this is just educational only. But ultimately, a Reg D debt fund is a highly liquid vehicle. It's a minimum one-year term. You can choose to make money monthly, quarterly, semi-annual, or annually. So the way I look at it is, hey, like, we're dating type situation. You're getting to know me, I'm getting to know you. You're testing us out, but you're not married to a 10-year fund where you have no liquidity and, you know, you make money in theory at these points. In the Reg D debt fund, you make money first, right? So it's a way of establishing a lot of trust to a new potential client. Then we have a Reg D equity fund. Right there, it's a 70-30 profit split. That's structured to be Sharia compliant. So some investors don't want to invest with any leverage whatsoever. This product is built for them. Then we have a Reg A Tier 2 fund. That fund is structured to be open to anybody. It's a fund that I can talk about freely. You know, it has a lot of SEC compliance. The minimum is 5K. It's a minimum 2-year investment period with annual liquidity, and is structured as an 80-22. What that means is 80% of profit goes to investors, 20% of profit comes to us, the GP, and there's a 2% management fee. So fundamentally, it comes down to like the person we're talking to, Charles. A lot of times, you know, when you're on our side of the space, when you're raising capital, it kind of becomes, hey, we want a 25K minimum, 50K minimum, 100K minimum, because it's more manageable for us, for our administrative team to manage the tax, to manage all of the things that are not fun to talk about that go on behind the scenes, right? But then when you lower the barrier of entry, then you can establish proof of concept for investors, and then they feel more comfortable scaling. Like I've had guys go from, you know, 10K, investing 10K to investing 1.7 million. You know, it's primarily on WhatsApp, right? And it's one of those things that like, how do you establish trust? You can, you know, create a podcast and educate people. You can post on LinkedIn, you can post on WhatsApp. But fundamentally, you know, a person has to get started somewhere. And the benefit of the Reg A fund is sometimes people feel like they can only make money if they have money. And that's inherently not the case. Like a lot of what I specialize in is showing you how you as the investor, you have money, you have some cash, you have your 401k that you could turn into a self-directed IRA. You have, you know, life insurance that you can use as cash value life insurance to invest with like a bank on yourself type concept. You have, you know, self-directed HSAs that you can use because you're young and you don't need the HSA money anyway. So it's better that it grows tax-free. There's a lot of different strategies. It just comes down to the individual, their risk tolerance, you know, the education piece, and if it aligns with their goals long-term.
That's great. Thank you. One of the things you mentioned with the Reg A was that $5,000 minimum investment. You don't have to be accredited. You can be a non-accredited investor. No matter what your status is, you can invest. Now, it strikes me with this is that I've always found Reg A's is really you're competing with like a REIT, a real estate investment trust, that maybe someone can invest right through their brokerage account, 401k, Roth, whatever it might be that they have. What would be, other than building a relationship with you on a smaller level, which is a great way of doing it, obviously you're trying out a sponsor with a minimal amount of money compared to $50,000 or $100,000, as you mentioned. And other than that, what would be one of the benefits of going in with, I imagine, direct ownership via the Reg A versus a REIT?
It's a great question. I think fundamentally it comes down to an individual's understanding of you know, financial products to begin with. Like a REIT is typically structured where they're reinvesting most of their profit and they're paying out the rest of the profit to you as the investor, right? So typically a REIT is a more mature company that's kind of, you know, kind of stabilized, kind of plateaued in terms of their growth. And typically they have a well-defined investment strategy. A lot of times, you know, it's like office space, things of that nature, right? And when you go to invest that 5K in the REIT, typically you're not talking to anybody. That human element that you mentioned, typically that's missing in terms of understanding the strategy and understanding like the growth potential and holding that REIT, you know, accountable year to year, right? So that's what you get kind of, you know, investing in a Reg A, whether it's with me or anyone who has a Reg A, is you have a point person that you can kind of talk to and say, okay, fundamentally, what is your strategy? How are you going to protect me on the downside? Because with a REIT, you can look at a chart online and you can get all this information. You can look at a 10-year chart and it'll give you that data. With a Reg A, you can do that as well. But then you can have that conversation to understand the strategy to say, hey, is this strategy well performed or well positioned to perform in the future? And that's, you know, a gut assessment as much as a due diligence assessment, where sometimes with a REIT, you can't necessarily do that, even though the information is available. The average investor doesn't necessarily have the access to or understanding of that information. So I think it comes down to accessibility. A lot of what we do in the private real estate space, and what you do as well, is about accessibility and educating people and saying, hey, these are the different strategies, right? Some of the strategies that I mentioned, you're not going to learn about by investing in Charles Schwab's platform in a REIT, because they're not going to talk to you about a self-directed HSA, which doesn't make sense in the short term, but in the long term, it's massive, right? In the short term, it's so much easier to just say, oh, I have $100 saved. Let me just use it for my deductible. But that $100 could grow tax-free for you for 40 years. And then you could use it for your nursing home.
Right.
Right. Now, would you rather have your nursing home expense paid or some $100 copay? You'd rather have the nursing home. It's going to be much more expensive.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're investing online with a robo-advisor, all of these things that exist that are cost-effective and that are great products, they're great products as long as you continue to educate yourself on what's possible financially. And that's the thing. Like, a REIT is a good investment. It has a space in your portfolio. But I think it comes down to what is the REIT investing in. If the REIT is investing in ground-up construction in the Northeast in multifamily, then compare my performance with them. And I would argue I'd probably outcompete them. If they're investing in the Sun Belt, in medical facilities or in storage or something else, you can compare them to me. But it's like comparing an apple and an orange. They're two different things. And for the average investor, when they think real estate, they think of it as some homogenous thing. Like, it's all the same. It's not. Each piece of real estate has a specific strength that you may or may not want in your portfolio, depending on your goals. And I think that's the difference, Charles. When we talk about, like, oh, just buy VOO, just buy, you know, the Vanguard ETF that tracks that S&P 500, that'll give you exposure to the whole market. But if you're like a growth investor, it's not the right play. If you're an investor that cares about dividends primarily, it's not the right play. And that's the same with REITs as well. It's good, but it's important to understand fundamentally what they're investing in.
Right. And also, they're not tax efficient. I mean, if you have it in a taxable account, I mean, you're paying very high taxes. I think ordinary income, speak to your CPA. I don't know exactly, but it's not like what we have going on here when we're doing our regulations where we're having depreciation and everything else.
Exactly.
Do you have money sitting in the stock market and you're worried about it? Or worse, you have money sitting at the bank, not keeping up with inflation? My name is Charles Carrillo, founder and managing partner of Harborside Partners. And since 2006, I've been investing my money and my family's money into income-producing properties. These are real assets, real properties with real addresses that produce real cash flow. At Harborside Partners, we provide passive investors who love real estate with a turnkey investing solution. If you want to put your money to work in real estate but can't find deals, don't have the time to get funding, and the last thing that productive people want to do is manage real estate. We find the deals, we fund the deals, and we manage the tenants, the termites, and the properties. Partner with us at investwithharborside.com. That's investwithharborside.com. Go to investwithharborside.com. If you love real estate, you like the idea of passive income, and believe that income-producing properties will appreciate over time, go to investwithharborside.com. That's investwithharborside.com.
You mentioned one thing about your products as we kind of move forward, and I want to get into WhatsApp and how you raise money. But one thing you talked about was the multifamily debt fund. And can you talk more about the type of products? Because what I see is that you have, I think you said 1 year was your minimum on that. Is that correct? Or 2 years? It's a low minimum. So, I mean, obviously you're putting debt out for longer periods, most likely. Can you explain what type of properties you're investing into and how there's that liquidity for investors to take out a distribution and or take out their capital?
Yeah. So typically in that debt fund, what we're doing is we're loaning out money to a developer that we've worked with for over a decade. We've done over $1 billion in transactions with him, right? So it's not necessarily a cheap loan for him. At the same time, he's doing ground up construction where there's huge value add. So it makes sense in the short term. So it's a part of our portfolio that we use just like the equity fund is, but it's fundamentally how do we get paid and then how do we pay investors. If in the equity fund, we're investing capital and we'll get paid between 9 and 15 months, depending on the project, right? A lot of our profit is realized at that event where we're selling to this developer, let's say, right? To our co-GP in that structure. Now we make money at the end of that transaction. So that's why we pay investors on a yearly basis. Now, meanwhile, in the debt fund, we're loaning out money on a shorter term basis, and they're different projects, right? So it's not cross collateralized or anything, but they're different projects. And what we're doing is it's a short term loan where he's paying us on a monthly basis. So if he's paying us on a monthly basis, we have the ability to pay our investors on a monthly basis, right? And that's really how it's structured. And that's why it's important to kind of understand how people want to make money. That way we can talk to them about the right product. Because for you and I, right, it is fun to talk about this. for you know, maybe the average real estate investor, it can be overwhelming or confusing. And while, like, I love providing all the information, I don't want to intentionally confuse people. So I'd rather just, like, curate the information on a call and then throw them all the information in an email and say, hey, based on our conversation, option one is the best, but here are the other, like, five options you can do, because I don't have all the information in that person's goals. So I want to give them all the tools to succeed. And that's why we've built out so many different products. But fundamentally, it's kind of up to them to help me guide them, if that makes sense, right? We're a team, and I rely on that feedback to then be able to structure the best products to accomplish, you know, the client's goals.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. The main thing is that you have customers, you have investors that are going to have, like you said, different goals and different timelines for those goals. So having the debt fund is great. I like that because it allows people with a shorter time horizon compared to going into an equity fund where it's going to be many years, right?
Yeah.
And it's obviously, you might have higher returns, but you're going to also have higher unknowns, higher risk, usually, you know what I mean?
And less liquidity, right? Like if exactly. You have, you know, if you have that situation where you have a kid going to college in 3-4 years, you don't want to lock it up in a 10-year fund. But maybe if another fund has a refinance projected in year 3, plus or minus 1 year, let's say, and you have a preferred return until that refi, then that makes more sense, because you're looking at it like, okay, I have this refinance event coming in a projected 3-year period. It's going to give me all my initial investment back plus profit in theory, and I'm not paying taxes on it because it's a refinance. Now it makes sense for me to hold this asset for, let's say, 20 years, because I'm getting all my money back in 3 years plus profit. So now I own that asset for free, and it's more of an infinite return type conversation.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. So you've raised tens of millions of dollars from investors, $20 million you mentioned from WhatsApp alone. Can you explain how you've successfully raised capital and some of the methods and platforms you've utilized?
Yeah, I think it comes down to luck. It comes down to access to amazing deal flow. Comes down to having, like, you know, high performing partners that are able to, you know, help me deliver. Just like anything, Charles, it's very easy for, you know, one person to be the face of something, but I think the reality is much more intricate. It takes a strong team to deliver amazing results, and that's, you know, what we're blessed to have. So really with WhatsApp, with all of these platforms, it comes down to the same formula, in my opinion, right? Like, you want to establish trust, and the best way to establish trust is to be yourself and spend time where it's natural for you to spend time. Right. So, like, if in the podcast example, you enjoy doing podcasts, right? So then spend that time there to network with people, educate people on that platform. And then people will inherently come to you and say, hey, I'm looking to invest in real estate, or I'm looking to do X, Y, and Z. Can you help me? Now, because you're on these platforms and you're talking about educational content, you also enjoy it. So you're happy to help people, and you don't necessarily need them to invest, because the deals will get funded with or without them. And I think that mindset is important, because fundamentally, when we're talking about, you know, investing, a lot of times these are private off-market opportunities that only you have access to, only I have access to, et cetera, right? And we know at a certain point, whether it's early on in our profession or later on, we know that there's a certain type of person that is looking for these opportunities. So we'll look for the person who's in need of that opportunity, and they'll look for us. And it ends up being a very beneficial relationship for both people. So that's really what I did on LinkedIn and on WhatsApp and on all these different, you know, platforms, is fundamentally look for people who are looking to invest, understand what they're looking to invest in, and understand how I can add value. That value might be me connecting them to Charles. That value might be me connecting them to a self-directed IRA custodian. It might be, you know, talking to them about different strategies outside of my core real estate, and by saying, listen, I'm not a CPA, I'm not a CFA. You know, I'm a person who manages my own money. You can think of me as a money coach. I don't have any of these, you know, three-letter degrees or anything. And all of those are important. But fundamentally, what I'm talking about is not necessarily financial advice or tax advice or anything. It's my own experience, because those disclaimers are important. But when you want to talk about real estate, I can talk to you about the experiences, how I've made people money, how I've, you know, raised capital, all of those things, by also disclaiming that, you know, past performance isn't indicative of future performance, right? Just because in one asset we're able to raise rent like 13% in 1 year doesn't mean this next asset will have the same situation. It might be a 6% raise, you know, in a year. Meanwhile, we're underwriting at 3%, right? So it just depends, and each situation is different. Fundamentally, it comes down to establishing trust. And the best way, in my opinion, is by being genuine, right? And the easiest way to be genuine is put yourself in positions where you want to be. If you don't want to be at investor dinners, don't do those. You know, if you don't want to be flying around the country, you know, meeting family offices, then don't do that. If you want to talk to non-accredited investors and you want to help them build wealth, then build a product like a Reg A, so that way you can legally do that. And then you can help people scale, so that way they have a path to say, okay, now I have money, now I can comfortably think about retirement. And then spend your time on that activity, because it's more genuine to you or me. So then we'll have more passion about it, and that'll be reflected in our voice and how we speak about our products. And then ultimately, it reinforces the fact that we're not here necessarily selling products. We're here building solutions. And that's a very important difference. And that's really how I look to structure all of my conversations, that you don't have to invest in real estate. You can use that self-directed IRA to angel invest. And that's a more strategic use of your dollars than using your liquid cash. And so those are the kind of conversations that I have, Charles. And that's really, I think, what's helped me be successful, is fundamentally having a good team, having good strategies, and then figuring out who I am and being genuine to that.
Yeah, no, that's a lot of great information. The interesting thing I think about the Reg A, which I feel is great, is that you're opening up the door, because if there's many deals out there that are only for accredited investors, and whatever stats you're using, non-accredited investors make up 88 or 92% of the United States, right? And we have this, like, say 10% that are accredited. So now that you're opening this up to a lot more investors and much lower entry points, which is, you can speak to a much wider audience. One thing I've had, or one question I've had that I've heard from one other operator in the Reg A area, is that it becomes a little bit more management intensive with onboarding and handling Reg A investors. It sounds like, you do a great job of educating your investors. How have you found that from your company standpoint?
No, I think it's a huge administrative burden, but it depends on, like, to me, the person is the most important thing, right? It's the most important to help people. But from a capital raising perspective and an administrative perspective and a scalability perspective, it comes down to how much you value your team's time/your time, et cetera, right? Now, the way I look at it is we have a 97% reinvestment rate. People who choose to work with us long-term typically, right? Now, if that person starts out at 5K and they're 25 and they're going to be with us, let's say, for 20 years, they're not going to stay at 25, at 5K. They're going to scale at whatever speed makes sense for them. If inherently my goal is financial freedom, what I talk about is financial freedom. I talk about strategies to help people optimize their money, make more money too, but optimize their money as well, right? My belief is that those Reg A non-accredited investors within 10 years will be accredited. Just by virtue of looking at my LinkedIn posts, by trying a couple of things, and by my performance for their portfolio. So now if that's the case, not only did I get the opportunity to work with them for a long period of time, I got the opportunity to deliver value for them outside of real estate performance, which is my strength, real estate performance, but I got to help them create financial freedom, which is really important to me on a personal level. Now they're no longer a non-accredited investor, they're an accredited investor who has quote unquote money, right? Who, like, would be a target for, you know, syndicators and allocators and things of that nature, and they're getting pitched deals all the time. That's great, I'm happy for them. They can choose to exit and they can choose to invest somewhere else. But at the same time, from their perspective, I've been adding value for 10 years. So the trust curve somebody else has to go through to outcompete me and my double-digit returns and all these different things is really difficult, because they look at it like, hey, I've worked with Mustafa for 5 years. I've worked with Mustafa for 10 years. And I know when I message him, he's really responsive. I know when it comes to getting my tax statements, I get them on time. When it comes to going on the investor portal, I have the information there. And I know when there's, like, issues or something or areas where Mustafa can improve, I communicate with him. And then over time, I see that improvement. So that's what I would say, Charles. I think it depends on how, as a capital raiser, it depends on how we look at our relationships/transactions. If it's long-term, if I'm young, you're young, we're going to be raising money for our whole life because that's what we enjoy doing. We enjoy investing, right? If that's the case, then accredited can be the way to go, while recognizing there might be more administrative work, because what it is you're dealing with a different person. The person who's non-accredited, who's looking to invest in real estate at an early point in their career, in my opinion, I don't have any stats, in my opinion, that person is very invested in financial education. They're very invested in figuring out how to make money. And that's what separates a lot of people, the intention to make money and to build that freedom, right? So what ends up happening is, in my opinion, they're more likely to get to financial freedom. They're more likely to have excess capital to invest. And they're going to invest with the people who invested with them, right? You invested your time initially when maybe they invested 5K. And honestly, maybe the firm lost money in that one transaction. But that person might have introduced you to people who have money. That person himself might grow because of the investment that you made in them. They might grow and be in a position later on where they have more capital, right? In that example, the 10K that I gave earlier on WhatsApp, the 10K investor, you know, he was early on. He made 4.5% in that first 3 months. He went to 50K. He stayed at 50K for 4 years. I met him in the first time overseas when I was in Asia. And that's the first time I met him. He lives 10 minutes away from me. The first time I met him was in a different continent. And he said, Mustafa, I'm having a massive liquidity event. What do I do? And I said, honestly, I don't know. What are your goals? What do you want to do? And then based on that, I can give you advice and, you know, try to help you. But my advice wasn't, you know, self-serving invest in real estate. It was fundamentally, how do you want to make money? What is your next career plan look like? Do you think you'll still be making, you know, 300K plus type numbers where you're accredited? Do you think you'll need monthly cash flow now that you're having this exit? What do you think you need so we can build out a strategy that makes your life easier? Because you don't want to have a massive liquidity event and then allocate it to the wrong strategies and then that money doesn't perform well. Because getting to that liquidity event wasn't easy either. So I think that's the thing, Charles. It comes down to how we approach these relationships. Are they transactional where it's okay, 100K in, check? Or is it kind of like, hey, you know, no one has infinite time, but to the best of my ability, I'm going to invest as much time as possible in each relationship to really help that individual scale. And, you know, if they refer people to me down the line, great. If they make, you know, money, quote unquote, become accredited, great. But fundamentally, at the very basic level, I'm helping them. So I feel happy. And then the rest will kind of sort itself out later. And that's really what's helped me my whole career, is really optimizing to create value and then monetize off that value later on.
Yeah. No, that's great. The good thing with the Reg A as well is that you're getting people comfortable as well with alternative investing, which yeah. I know for a lot of our investors, first time in the alternative investing space, right? Getting outside of, like you said, Schwab, that brokerage, and getting into something where relationships matter, right? And learning more about an investment that you might not be able to read about on a lot of different financial websites. So that's number one. And I think the other thing that I've seen too is that, to kind of like validate your point as well about larger investments, we've seen typically when on our second reinvestment, it usually goes 50% to 100% higher on that second investment than on the first one. And we've gone full cycle on it, or if just that is running correctly, you know what I mean? Then you're going to get that. And so I see that as an easier way of getting people in the door with the Reg A. So that's a great strategy. I never heard it explained like that. So thank you.
No, it's really powerful, Charles. And I agree with everything you said, because for us, even we would think, oh, it has to be full cycle to then go and raise more capital. But fundamentally, people just want a good experience, right? They want to see that you're doing the basic things right, things like communication, things like follow-up, things like, are my tax documents coming on time, right? It's a very basic thing. But in the private real estate space, you know, sometimes it's challenging because we're dealing with so much scale, right?
Yeah, perfect. So how can our listeners learn more about you and your business?
Yeah, great question. So they can reach out to me via email. That's ml@veloce, VELOCE. Capital, CAPITAL.com. They can also, you know, visit our website, VelocheCapital.com, or they can, you know, connect with me on LinkedIn. It's Mustafa, MUSTAFA, and the last name is Ladha, LADHA.
Well, perfect. Thank you so much for coming on today. I'll put all those links into the show notes, and hopefully we'll be able to connect here again in the near future.
Thank you, Charles. I appreciate it. Have a good one, everyone.
Hi guys, it's Charles from the Global Investors Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you're interested in getting involved with real estate, but you don't know where to begin, set up a free 30-minute strategy call with me at SchedulCharles.com. That's SchedulCharles.com. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Global Investor Podcast. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play to get new weekly episodes. For more resources and to receive our newsletter, please visit globalinvestorpodcast.com. And don't forget to join us next week for another episode.
Nothing in this episode should be considered specific, personal, or professional advice. Any investment opportunities mentioned on this podcast are limited to accredited investors. Any investments will only be made with proper disclosure, subscription documentation, and are subject to all applicable laws. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, financial, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own. Information is not guaranteed. All investment strategies have the potential for profit or loss. The host is operating on behalf of Syndication Superstars, LLC, exclusively.